The misinformation that is so prevalent in our society today, whether through organized media campaigns or grassroots efforts in social media, or many would say in the Maricopa County ballot recount, has overtaken much of the confidence that a significant majority had in U.S. institutions, had being the key word of the previous sentence. To counter that, how much is required of groups, new and old, and how much do we as individuals have to learn more and pay attention? In his latest book, The Constitution of Knowledge, A Defense of Truth, Brookings scholar Jonathan Rauch explores those and many other questions, and he's with me. Jonathan, just how dire is the situation right now when it comes to people understanding what's going on and being able to disagree with others from an actual base of knowledge?
Well, it's certainly not a good situation. Americans are more polarized by most measures than we have been since the Civil War. 60% of the public told pollsters last summer that they were not expressing their true political beliefs for fear of offending someone. This concern actually spans the ideological spectrum. It's not just conservatives who feel chilled. A third of Americans say they're worried that they'll lose a job or career opportunities if they express their true views on politics. And that's just as true of progressives as it is of conservatives. So we have a pretty stifling climate. Some sociologists have done a study finding that the level of chilling now is about four times what it was during the height of the McCarthy era.
How much of that does fall on us as individuals, as communities, as groups to know more? And how much of the Constitution of Knowledge is built on the idea that we all need to understand more as opposed to just being turned into saps, which is kind of what it sounds like at times?
Well, if I could just take a minute to explain what the Constitution of Knowledge
yes,
is,
please do.
That'll help put your question in perspective. So most of us, if you ask Americans, where does knowledge come from? How do we find truth? How do we reach at least agreement on important public questions? They'll say marketplace of ideas. If you have free speech, then knowledge, truth will emerge from that. But that's not really right, actually. All that emerges from that is a cacophony and people chasing each other down their tribal rabbit holes and confirming their own biases and not listening to other people. You need a lot of structure in the marketplace of ideas. And that's the Constitution of Knowledge. And that's all the rules and institutions and values that we have that say, you know, you're going to have to persuade other people. You're going to have to do it in a rational, systematic fashion. You're going to, if you want to publish something, you're going to go to a journal. And there's going to be some vetting that goes on. A lot of different people are going to be exposed to your opinion, and they're going to decide whether it's true. So that's the Constitution of Knowledge. It's like the U.S. Constitution because it requires people to persuade and compromise in order to make law or to make knowledge. That worked so well for so long that we kind of took it for granted and just assumed that we could go about our business, not realizing that the combination of new technology and new tactics would completely upend that system. And that's where we are now. So you ask, are individuals responsible for that? I say, kind of, but not really. We were completely taken by surprise, Steve. So a couple of very important changes happened. One is, of course, the rise of social media, digital media, which had some good effects, but made it extremely easy to mob and shame anyone just by pressing a button at the drop of the hat, to swarm them, to drag them, to demolish their reputation, even to get them fired from their job. It's horrendous if it happens, and it became trivially easy, and people weaponized that. Another huge change, I hate to say this, it sounds partisan, and I'm center-right. I voted for many Republicans, but Donald Trump is the greatest propaganda innovator since the 1930s, and he understood how to adapt Russian-style disinformation tactics like the fire hose of falsehood to U.S. politics and installed that. And that's been extremely disruptive. It's, of course, polarizing, but it's also very confusing. People don't know who to believe anymore. And those tactics have also worked very well. We've never had a president do that before. No one's even imagined doing it before. So individuals were taken by surprise. But yeah, the next step is for us, all of us collectively, to understand what's going on, that we're the victims of a targeted attack here, and get smarter about that and begin reorganizing and fighting back.
Who benefits from what you're describing? And then how can people be convinced to benefit from the Constitution of Knowledge and looking at it in a different way?
Great questions. Who benefits? Okay, so what we're talking about here in the big picture, all of the things we're talking about, both cancel culture, which is social coercion, and disinformation, what we're talking about is information warfare. And that's where people organize and manipulate the social and media environments to divide, disorient, demoralize, and disrupt the other side. And that's, so there are lots of ways to do that, and they're age old. So who would want to do that? Well, for example, if you're a dictator and you want to install yourself and people telling the truth about you are an obstacle, say the press, if you want to have a cult of personality, the first thing you're going to do is try to demolish all the institutions around you that point out falsehoods, find your errors, subject you to scrutiny. If you want political power, if you're a demagogue, the Constitution of Knowledge stands directly in your way because it's saying, wait, hold on a minute. Can you prove that? Can you demonstrate that to other kinds of people? Or suppose you're a faction, you're a small group, you know, or medium-sized group, like on a college campus at a liberal arts college or online, and you have very strong views about racism and you're absolutely sure you're right and you think the other side is just downright evil and you want to silence them for political advantage and make people think that actually you're the majority view. Well, you can do that by doing an online mob and then threatening someone's job, and people get quickly intimidated by that. They say, I'd better not speak out. So these are all ways of manipulating the environment so that what's false looks true, what's true looks false. People are no longer sure what other people believe. People often aren't even sure what they believe.
Is there an elitism to this sort of thing? Are we as a society able to absorb, and I don't mean intellectually absorb, of course, if people want to put their minds to it, they can, but to have concepts like this.
Steve, I've been amazed at how much traction this book is getting, even though it's the most challenging book I've ever written. I've discovered that actually a lot of people like it when they see some rigor on the page and when you show your work and when they're challenged with ideas. You use the word elite. I'm going to switch to a different word, and it really is different, and that's professional. The knowledge-making community, I call it the reality-based community. That's science and academia, it's mainstream journalism, it's law and the courts, and it's government, you know, statistical agencies, for example. So what we're trying to do here isn't saying just trust elites blindly, but it is saying empower our professionals again, the people who spend their lives learning the skills of how to find knowledge, how to check for error. We need to re-empower them. And yeah, it's an open question whether in a society as populist as ours, and frankly, as bombarded with attacks on professionals as ours has been, it's an open question whether we can do that.
The new book is called The Constitution of Knowledge, A Defense of Truth. The author is Jonathan Rauch. Jonathan, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you. And don't forget, I'm a proud graduate of Camelback High School in Phoenix, Arizona.